If you look at evolutionary history, we are comprised of genes, and as biological organisms, those genes are kind of the blueprints to some degree of who we are and how we work. And so if you look at kind of Charles Darwin, the theory of natural selection, and you look at a lot of the early work by Gregor Mendel, you probably see intro biology textbooks, you know, that they were playing around with peas and seeing how genes kind of reproduced in successive generations.
Ian Moreau, a researcher at the University of Manitoba, who is doing his PhD on environmental and socioeconomic risks and benefits of genetically modified crops, led a discussion at the University of Winnipeg on November 3, 2005, on genetically modified organisms, GMOs, and related issues. Moreau has been studying GMOs for the past 4 years and has had the opportunity to talk to many world experts about the subject. During this time, he and others have also been working on a documentary which will be released November 30th in Winnipeg that deals with this issue and the impact GMOs have on farmers. In the next half hour, we will talk about the history of genetically modified organisms and about farmers and the fact that they are losing control of their own crops. We will also examine where the push for this kind of research into GMOs is coming from and talk about the Green Revolution and issues it has caused in India. In his discussion, Moreau talked about genetically modified organisms and the history of genetics.
We've really kind of only started to become aware of how genes operate, you know, in the past kind of couple hundred years. And we certainly are only starting to really begin to understand how genetics truly operates. And, you know, in the year 2000, they mapped the human genome, and you may have heard of that. It was kind of like the equivalent of man walking on the moon, you know, just a massive kind of discovery and leap in terms of our knowledge of the world and how we kind of interact with it. And those recent discoveries around kind of the human genome are just starting to kind of give us some insight into how genetics truly works. And so it's a newly kind of emerging field. And while there's a long kind of history recently around kind of genetics, and you know, we've got biotechnology being commercialized and genetic engineering happening, I would argue that it's relatively poorly understood. We can do it; it doesn't necessarily mean we understand it. And so, when you start looking at kind of the history of organisms, it's important to kind of look at kind of species concepts. So a species is, you know, more or less defined as a particular entity, biological entity that can pretty much replicate with itself. So you don't have kind of chickens breeding with horses, and you don't have kind of, you know, people breeding with fish, right? And that's because we're species and we can't cross that species boundaries. We have kind of constraints that aren't absolute. There's kind of things that break the species boundary, but it's classically defined as you know, these biological vessels that can only self-replicate within the species. And genetic engineering breaks with that. And basically, you know, as biological species, we've only been able to pass our genetic heritage within our species. And there's some organisms that break that model, and so it's not absolute, but generally speaking, that's how kind of evolutionary history has worked, that's how kind of natural selection has worked. And now we're at a stage where scientists have figured out how to cross the species boundary, and they've figured out how to take genes out of one organism and put them into another organism. And that's basically a genetically modified organism, is when you cross the species boundary. And the terminology around GMOs is often poorly understood at best, and often it's ahead of the science. And so there's technology deployed, but the scientific understanding of that technology isn't necessarily well understood. And so, yeah, to the definition, the genetically engineered or genetically modified organism is something that crosses the species boundary. And so in that way, it's a major departure from our biological history. We've never been able to cross the species boundary like that before. And so we're in a situation where we are fundamentally altering our biological and genetic lineage when we start to do that. And a lot of people will say there's no problem. A lot of people say that there's huge problems associated with that. And so in a lot of ways, it's interestingly a battle for language. And if you kind of do your Google searches and, you know, checking on the internet for information, you know, you'll come up with Frankenfoods, you'll come up with, you know, Terminator technology, you'll come up with all the kind of rhetoric on one side, and then on, and that's kind of the anti-GMO. And then on the kind of pro side, you know, they won't even call it genetically modified organisms. They try and strip it from any of the controversial language. They'll say it's the same as traditional breeding. And so traditional breeding is like Gregor Mendel, the guy that was playing with the peas, you know, taking a little bit of pollen off of one pea and putting it onto, you know, another, and trying to kind of cross plants using their natural processes. And that is largely how humanity has developed all the major crop cultivars that we have. And so farmers through, you know, thousands of years have basically bred wheat, for example, to the place where it is. So wheat is about, it was domesticated between 10 and 12,000 years ago. And people throughout all of that history have taken those plants. And so if there was a disease in one area, farmers would band together, find the plants that hadn't been killed by a disease, and take that plant and breed it and cultivate it out as a form of protection. And so that seed from plants that had natural resistance or had grown better in certain kind of soil and climatic conditions, farmers would take those and they would cultivate them. And in a lot of ways, farmers would help each other by passing out the seed, because it was a community effort. In one person, if they had disease resistance, it didn't matter. They needed to share that with their neighbors to fight off disease resistance in crops. And so agriculture was very much a communal activity, and in that way, farmers working together over, you know, centuries have bred the modern major agricultural cultivars to what they are today. And so wheat, Canadian wheat is some of the highest grade wheat in the world, and Agriculture Canada has some of the highest grade wheat germplasm, which is the kind of genetic base for those cultivars, and that particular germplasm is, you know, it's priceless. You couldn't put a price on how much that actually costs in terms of, you know, humanity's development of that crop. And it coming over from the old world to the new world, and people working on it here, and so agriculture is got a very long history to it in that way, and the history is fundamentally linked to breeding. And so once again, one, genetic engineering not only is a departure in terms of our species lineage, in terms of, you know, biological organisms and crossing the species boundary, it's also a major departure in terms of agriculture and how agriculture is practiced, because we're no longer breeding species within the species kind of boundary, and there's these species crosses happening.
Breeding has in many ways been taken out of the hands of farmers, with research scientists, universities, land-grant institutes, and with something called land breeders' rights, which gives scientists who breed plants exclusive rights. Therefore, the control of crops has increased over the years.
It's ironic that in a lot of ways, farmers are no longer in control of agriculture. There's a lot of big companies that control the agenda and control the research and control the marketing and control a lot of things in agriculture. And science has been a major force in that science as a doctrine or ideology has really created hierarchies of knowledge. And so you have kind of farmers who, for, you know, most of our agricultural history were the ones doing the science, right? They were the ones breeding and they were the ones working with the crops. And then, you know, the Enlightenment happened, Francis Bacon, Descartes, all these guys basically, and guys being, you know, is very gender specific, science started very as a very male dominated discipline, started to say, well, wait a second, we can do things, there's a scientific method here, we can kind of figure things out better than anybody else can, and science started to develop as a way of knowing that started to exclude non-scientific knowledge from the way in which decisions were made. And now we are in a situation where the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, the government organization that regulates biotechnology in Canada, only makes decisions using a science-based framework. And so genetically engineered crops are either introduced or not introduced into the environment based on science and science alone. And Roundup Ready wheat, you may have heard of this, GM wheat, that particular crop was so controversial and it basically broke the regulatory mold because in past introductions of GMO crops, science was kind of the decision-making framework for how to decide whether or not a crop went into the environment or not. And prior to GM wheat and prior to canolas were introduced in 1996, genetically modified canolas, and they're genetically modified to be herbicide tolerant. So the genes that are put into these crops, into the canola crop, are for the most part herbicide tolerance genes. A lot of those genes come from bacteria, and so these bacteria can survive living in herbicide, and they pluck the particular gene sequences out of these bacteria, put them into the canola, the gene sequences that are resistant to the herbicide, put it into the canola, and then you now have a herbicide-tolerant canola. So you can spray the canola with herbicide. It has a gene in it that makes it not die, and it kills all the weeds, but it doesn't kill the canola. And those particular canolas were introduced in 1996. And that was prior to people really understanding a lot about what was happening and what the implications of that introduction were. And so Roundup Ready wheat, GMO wheat, that was kind of the second big wave of ag biotechnology, GMOs in Canada. There was other introductions, but canola and wheat were the kind of, have been two of the big kind of commercially grown crops. And so farmers had learned a lot, and people in general had learned a lot about what the pros and cons were of GMO canola due to its introduction. So when GMO wheat came up, people understood what the risks were and they understood what the benefits were, and it was a much more kind of visceral fight over the introduction of that crop. And it basically broke the scientific-based regulatory system because the Canadian Wheat Board, which is the single desk seller for Canadian hard red spring wheat, they basically pool all the farmers' wheat in Western Canada, and they sell wheat on behalf of farmers to markets all over the world, and they're a huge, huge organization. And the Canadian wheat market, I believe, is worth about $4 billion annually. And so when GMO wheat started to come down the pipe, the Canadian Wheat Board started doing market analysis and started asking their buyers, okay, if we introduce a GMO wheat in Canada, will you accept it? Will you take it?
It is obvious that the push for this kind of research into the genetically modified organisms is not coming from farmers. Therefore, the question one has to ask is where this push is coming from.
The push for GMOs is largely about, in my opinion, we can do it, so we should. There's that kind of mentality with technology that if it's available, you should just do it, because that's how technology and innovation and, you know, quote unquote progress works, is that we have these tools, we have to use them. And so there's just, I think, an ideological push in society to just move forward because we can. The push, we can do it, so we should do it, I think is something that a lot of people in society share. I think we all, at some level there's, and I'm not going to speak for everyone here, but I think collectively there's a psyche in the world that's why we've got a lot of the things that we have, you know, now. And all of us around the table might not share that view, but progress is this kind of ideological thing that just makes things happen regardless of whether or not it's necessarily good or bad. But beyond that, this idea around kind of the privatization of agriculture, I would say, is the major push specifically for GMOs. If you look at recent history, and so you look at the patent structure, and this is an integral part of this whole kind of GMO debate, is that companies really didn't start to get into genetic engineering in agriculture until a landmark decision by the patent by the Supreme Court in the US in 1980. And there was a Supreme Court decision called Diamond and Chakrabarty. It was Diamond versus Chakrabarty. And that Supreme Court decision was based on this Chakrabarty fellow was a scientist for GE, General Electric, and he had genetically engineered a bacteria that had properties that made it useful for cleaning up, I think it might have been oil. It was some sort of kind of remediation, a bacteria that could remediate some sort of toxic substance. And GE said, you know, Chakrabarty, how come you haven't claimed a patent on this? You know, you've created this thing, how come you haven't tried to get a patent on it? And GE, being a big kind of technology developer from light bulbs to nuclear weapons, you know, they why aren't you trying to claim ownership of this? And so he, along with GE, went all the way to the Supreme Court in the States, and Diamond was the commissioner of patents. So it was Diamond versus Chakrabarty. So it was literally kind of the government of the US against this guy working for a corporation. And the commissioner of patents said you shouldn't be able to patent a living organism. And a bacteria is a living organism. It's small, but you still shouldn't be able to patent it. And in 1980, the Supreme Court ruled that you could patent living organisms. And that was the kind of critical decision that started the mad rush to patent biological organisms. And so genetic engineering and the transformation, that's another word they use, the transformation of kind of agricultural crops didn't really start until that, because there wasn't really an incentive to invest on the part of the corporate sector. And so once that became an option, well, if we can do the science and then we can own it, well, there's a reason for us to go after that. And so there was sort of genetic engineering's birth commercially really started out of that decision. There was the science before that for sure, and there was a lot of science happening, you know, through the kind of late 60s, early 70s, but not until the early 80s did the commercialization of the technology really start to take off. And when you start to look at your trade agreements and, you know, the WTO and whatnot kind of emerging out of that time period, and the kind of globalization of the world starting to happen, you know, patents and the development of the GATS and the development of, you know, the trading of intellectual property, that all started to happen simultaneously with these court decisions. And so once the companies realized not only can you patent them, but you can start to own things, you know, unilaterally across the world because of these trade agreements and whatnot, it started to become very fruitful for these companies to invest huge amounts of money because they could get control over the genetic structures that they patented, and not only the genetic structures but the actual organisms themselves.
Moreau talked about the Green Revolution, its history and pros and cons. He also used India as an example of this and talked about Vandana Shiva, an Indian researcher who received her PhD in Ontario. Shiva is a physicist who got involved in the Chipko movement, which is a deforestation movement in India.
The breeding of crops really kind of hit its apex when Norman Borlaug developed these high-yielding wheat and rice varieties, and so they figured out how to breed plants to be dwarfed varieties so they didn't grow stalks. They just grew basically roots and then the fruit and the grain, and they were able to develop these high-yielding varieties that caused the Green Revolution in the States. Through Norman Borlaug, started to export kind of U.S.-style agriculture all over the world. And, you know, he won a Nobel Peace Prize for his ability to change crops through traditional breeding in a way that created huge surpluses of food. And there's no doubt that the Green Revolution saved people's lives in certain areas and brought new food to very hungry regions. And that definitely happened. And so when the Green Revolution was basically the apex of breeding, and they created these plants that produce huge kind of yields, and that was great. Norman Borlaug won a Nobel Prize for it, but there was unanticipated consequences of that, and the fact was that a lot of these high-yielding varieties required massive amounts of inputs. They were made to grow like crazy. They were made to produce huge amounts of food for people, but they required an input, and that input in a lot of cases was water and irrigation. Some cases, to do the irrigation, it required gas, and it required pumps, and it required tillage, and it required chemical inputs. And so people were sold a bill of sale that these crops in some regions will save your lives and you'll grow tons of food, but there was all these other kind of associated inputs that had to kind of come with it. And so in India, the Green Revolution spawned madness. If you read some of the writings, and even the most kind of hardcore proponents of the Green Revolution, they also recognized that there was major complications with it. And there's a book called The Doubly Green Revolution that talks about the Green Revolution and then biotechnology as the second wave of another kind of Green Revolution feeding, you know, the masses and whatnot. But what happened in India was incredible violence. I met Vandana Shiva. I got to interview her, and she's in some of the movies that we do. But she explained to us some of the things that were happening in India that she witnessed. And so she was completely upset by this. She wrote a book called The Violence of the Green Revolution. So people fighting over, people killing themselves because they went into such high debt around, you know, oh, we can feed ourselves, but now we owe all this money for all the inputs, you know. And so it was kind of this, there was a hook attached. And so she basically, as a physicist, dropped her career to go and fight for the freedom movement in agriculture in India. And so she describes her personal kind of odyssey as having to get out of physics to fight for biodiversity and agriculture in India. And basically, the Green Revolution happened, and she said that when she started to see what these big biotech companies were doing with this second wave of the doubly Green Revolution, she had to step out of her role as an academic researcher, physicist, and become an activist to fight for her people in India. And she makes the analogy that in India, obviously, they have a huge independence movement, and Gandhi, and you know, the fighting, fighting for control of their materials and clothing, and so the British Empire couldn't sell cotton to them, you know, and all of the fight over independence in India, she links back to her modern fight over biotechnology, and she says that Gandhi used the spinning wheel as the freedom of independence. That was the symbol for independence, because it was, you know, we'll spin our own material. We won't have to buy it from a foreign nation anymore. And she says that in India, the seed is the new symbol for the freedom movement in India, because in India, in terms of biopiracy, these companies started to go into India where there were some very lucrative plants, one of them being the neem tree. And if you kind of go into any health food store, you'll see kind of neem products. It's a naturally occurring antiseptic, and it's used from toothpaste to kind of, you know, all sorts of kind of medicinal qualities for cleaning things and whatnot. And there was a company that went in, realized that the neem tree had some huge kind of medicinal properties. They took some of the germplasm and genetic material from this tree, took it back to the U.S., patented the material, and basically claimed that they owned the neem tree. And it happened again. This Texas multinational agricultural company patented basmati rice. And so they went to India, And they took the kind of rice out of the country, and I'm not sure exactly what they did. They technically would have had to have transformed it, but you can, as long as you can extract the DNA and the gene sequence of a organism and replicate it outside of that organism and mass produce it outside of that organism, you can patent it, because you've taken the naturally occurring sequence out, you've replicated it, and you've created a process to manufacture it. And so technically you own all of those genes that are manufactured out of your process, because it's not part of the organism anymore. And so there's this kind of legal procedure by which companies can own the genetic sequences of these original plants. And so they took ownership of basmati rice, and Vandana Shiva's group in India has been, you know, very successful in fighting these patents, and very successful around publicizing the fact that that's, you know, to many of us completely insane that a company could do that. You know, and when, once again, looking at the history of agriculture and looking at the history of these plants and biodiversity as we know it, biodiversity is intrinsically linked to the people that interact with that biodiversity. And, you know, humans are a part of the biological world, and arguably humans have cultivated it just as much as it's cultivated itself over time. And so the people in a region are intrinsically linked to their biological diversity, and they are the ones that have community ownership. And ownership's probably the wrong word, you know, they have a community stewardship. The people in these regions where biopiracy is occurring, specifically in India, have been very successful at vocalizing how crazy this is, and have had a lot of the patents rescinded in India. That's not the case in other parts of the world, though. And, you know, that those kind of patents are happening all over the place. Those kinds of patents are happening in human bodies. And so this isn't just a discussion about agriculture. Those kinds of patents are literally being taken out on the human genome.
You have been listening to the first part of a discussion on genetically modified organisms, which was led by Ian Moreau, a researcher at the University of Manitoba, who is doing his PhD on environmental and socioeconomic risks and benefits of genetically modified crops. Ian has been studying genetically modified organisms for the past 4 years, and has had the opportunity to talk to many world experts about this subject. My name is Bojan Dulabic, and this documentary was produced for CKUW's The Beat, 95.9 FM, Winnipeg.